Thank you very much. Let me start by thanking the organizers for a wonderful conference and a wonderful workshop. I am a theoretical chemist, and I'm interested in collisions of molecules. And collisions of molecules are important in many fields, in astrochemistry, atmospheric chemistry, and combustion. Colliding molecules drive important processes. And the field of cold molecules is particularly interesting because it, on the one hand, can sometimes provide amazingly detailed information at a quantum level of what happens during collisions, and it also raises some questions where we sometimes can use some of our machinery to help predict possibilities for experiments. So today I will be talking about two specific systems. The first system is the collision of OH radicals and NO radicals. And this is motivated by an experiment that was done at the Fritz Haber Institute in Berlin, where over the years they developed the Stark deceleration technique, initially to slow down molecules, hydroxyl molecules. And then later it was realized that you can not just slow them down, but you can actually control the velocity of the molecules, prepare them in a single quantum state, and use it to do collision experiments. And the collision experiments here were done in a range of 70 to 300 wave numbers. So it's not cold, but it is in a pure quantum state and with controlled velocities. And there were results. Several inelastic channels, the cross sections were measured in absolute units. And well, we try to see if we can understand this, sort of test our ability to calculate cross sections. And in a way, this is sort of a follow-up study of a 2006 study where atom molecule, atom radical collisions were studied, and I'll show how molecule is quite different from atom molecule. The other system I will discuss is collisions of NH radicals. The 15 NH is a boson, and here the experiment has not been done. What has been done so far is the NH radical has been cooled with the buffer gas cooling technique, and it's trapped, so it's available around a Kelvin. And the question is, can it be brought down to the ultra-cold regime with evaporative cooling? And we have put in quite a bit of effort to try to predict the relevant Zeeman cross-sections and the elastic cross-sections. And over the years, the theory was promising. And the one thing we had not yet put in was the possible chemical reactions. And in this study, I will show what if you also the possibility of chemical reaction, what will happen with the NH-NH collisions. And so here it's very much trying to help predict the feasibility of evaporative cooling experiment. So before I go on, let me first mention the people involved in the work. First of all, Lisbeth Janssen is the PhD student who did all the work on the NH-NH collisions, and there are some other theorists. I also want to mention Jeremy Hudson, who was very much involved in earlier studies on the NH. On the experimental side, there's a big team in Berlin, and maybe I should point out Bas van der Meeracker, the project leader, and he is now in Nijmegen, and our funding. So let me start with the experiment. The experiments involved the Stark decelerator, which is producing the beam of OH radicals in a single quantum state at a velocity that is controlled by putting the proper voltages on the electrodes. And the OH radical can be seen with laser-induced fluorescence. And what is nice about this experiment is that it is exactly known, the quantum state, the velocity, but also the spatial distribution of the molecules, because they can be easily seen with the laser. Now, so this is the OH beam. Then there is another beam made with a hexapol in which the NO radical is prepared. That's a little less controlled. It comes out with one velocity, but it is a pure quantum state. And because this is also a molecule that can be easily detected, also the NO is known exactly, the quantum state and the spatial distribution. And that is sort of extra compared to previous experiment with xenon plus OH, because the rare gas atom cannot be seen so easily with lasers as a molecule. And because it's possible to know the spatial distribution density of the molecules, the experiment actually provide absolute cross-section, which is a particular interesting challenge for us then to try the absolute value of the cross-sections. So what is the process we are looking at? So here I show the energy levels of OH and NO. And for OH, we have two fine structure systems, the 3/2 and the 1/2. And then we have a ladder of rotational levels. The lowest rotational level is 3/2. And there are two parity states. And the state that is prepared in the Stark decelerator is the upper component, the F parity state. And this state is focused, and the other parity state actually is expelled from the Stark decelerator. So the Stark decelerator very much produces the upper state and utterly removes all E parity states. And maybe that is actually as important as all the control and other features. Because that means that, in particular, all the E parity states are totally expelled from the beam, giving extremely low concentrations. And that is important because in these collisions, the densities in these beams are still pretty low. So you do not produce a lot of molecule. Typically, in a collision in this experiment, you produce, you know, 1 out of 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 or even 10 to the 6 collisions actually will give a state-to-state transition, and so you produce very little products. But because there are the e-parity states are totally filtered out of the machine, whatever is produced can be measured with a good signal-to-noise ratio. So the experiment provides information on the transitions to e-parity states, and that can be a rotation transition to the 5/2, the 7/2, or the spin orbit transition. The NO, which has a larger moment of inertia, a smaller rotational constant, many more rotational levels, but again, it's produced in this hexapol beam in a single quantum state. If we try to study, calculate what happens in the collision, we have this Hamiltonian. The radial kinetic energy, the end over end rotation of the complex, say the partial waves, and then we have the Hamiltonians of the separate molecules, the Hamiltonian of OH and the Hamiltonian of NO, and an interaction potential. Well, the monomers, of course, is known in great detail. There's the rotation. We have seen that is spin orbit coupling, and there is lambda doubling, which gives the splitting between the E and F parity states, and we know this in great detail. What we don't know so well is the interaction potential, and the typical approach for a theoretical chemist is to do ab initio calculations and try to calculate, you know, as we have seen, Joel Bowman, you know, calculate 50,000 points and make a fit. And then, you know, a year later you have something, but here we have a problem because we have two doublet radicals. So that means we will have singlet and triplet potentials. Okay, we can do that. But also both molecules are in a pi state. So they are doubly degenerate spatially. And so in the collision, you will have four spatially degenerate electronic states. So in the end, asymptotically, we have eight degenerate states, which are during the collision. So we have to deal with eight potential energy surfaces. And then on top of that, because they are close together in energy, we would have to consider the non-adiabatic couplings between the states. And well, that sort of is becoming impossible to do in 1 year. So the first thought was this system is hopeless and maybe not the thing we should be working on. But then, because there was data and we wanted to try something, we thought, okay, what we can deal with is the long range. The long range interaction, we have two molecules as dipoles, so something can be expected to happen at long range. So let's forget about spending a decade calculating the potentials. Let's just see what we can do with what we know, at least in the long range, and then do the full quantum scattering, because that we can do using a simple model for the potential, which is the hard part. So we made a model where what we put in is basically the electrostatic interaction. Dispersion, we only took the isotropic part of the dispersion, and then the short range, we have to do something. We don't want a singularity in our potential, so we basically just put an exponential wall. That means whenever in our calculations we make it to that point, whatever happens is meaningless. But many collision events, you will not actually make it to this short distance, and then what happens with these terms may be realistic. So the electrostatic potential, well, this is how we like to expand it, but really what it is, it's dipole-dipole interaction, and then we know the quadrupole and the octupole moments of the molecule, so it's dipole-dipole, dipole-quadrupole, etc., the well-known first-order interaction terms. And then, well, we do, because we're so used to running ab initio calculations, we did do some ab initio points to compare it to our long range model. So the points here are ab initio calculations, and the curves are this model. And what you can see is up to, say, 10 Bohr, from 10 Bohr and further out, you know, the agreement between a decent ab initio calculation and this model is good. But when you get, well, you see sort of around, well, below 8, maybe 6 Bohr, the model becomes sort of meaningless. Well, with this model, we started a couple channels calculations. So this is not cold or ultra cold, so that means we have to deal with a lot of OH states. We include up to J equals 9.5, for the NO up to 7.5. The total partial waves for the end over end rotation of the complex up to 200, and that gives us a few thousand coupled channels which we propagate, and we have to propagate far out compared to a normal calculation, 35 atomic units, because we have the long-range dipole-dipole interaction. Of course, it's not ultra-cold. We don't have to go to 10,000 Bohr, but still pretty far. And then this is what we find. The points here are the experimental results, and the curves are the theory. This is the collision energy scale. It runs, well, the experiments were done from 70 wave number to 300 wave number. And cross sections were measured for four inelastic processes. The first one is the change of the parity of the OH. So in this experiment, you only look at the OH. It begins in the 3.5F. And after the collision, it can end up in the 3.5E. This is a process that takes almost no energy. And a cross-section comes out of in the order of 100 square angstrom. And in absolute units in the experiment from the modeling of the density, the spatial distribution of the molecules. And this is our... The 5.5, that is a rotational transition, and again you see the, and that's now a different scale, that's 10 square angstrom, and there you see a rotational transition, and then there are higher rotational states for which here you can zoom in, this is a scale, right, this is 1 square angstrom, and then you see excitation to 7.5, so one additional rotational quantum, and this the one half e is, or the blue actually, that is the spin orbit changing transition. And the experiment had an error bar. I just want to point that out. So for at this energy, 90 square angstrom plus or minus 40 was what came out of the statistics and modeling of the experiment. And then there are error bars due to, you know, they did many shots. So in a way, this is a surprise, because this is for these channels amazing agreement. So that basically means, it was amazing to us, but it simply means that this long-range model is actually describing what is happening in these inelastic processes. And in hindsight, maybe it's not so surprising that the things that happen at a relatively large impact parameter are the ones that give big cross-sections, and those happen to be the processes that we can actually calculate. We also analyzed our results a little bit further, because in the calculation we can actually also see what happens with the NO, and we can also do that at lower energies than what was done in the experiment. And then it's sort of interesting to see at 10 wave numbers, if you look at the product where you have the parity changing in the OH, and that is the dominant channel, then in that dominant channel, what is happening to the NO? And you see then the NO also, the parity changes. And that is actually, it makes perfect sense, because that's exactly what the dipole-dipole interaction will do. So if you go to lower collision energies, the parity flip of both molecules is exactly what is going to be dominant. And then the dominant inelastic process. And here you see the elastic cross-sections are still a little bit bigger than this parity changing process. So just very briefly, this is the old result on the xenon OH. And here it was not an absolute unit, as I explained. And well, if you compare the collisions, well, there's a little bit difference in the cross sections. You can compare that, but what is actually maybe the most important difference is that here, in order to get these results, which were also very good, we had to calculate an ab initio potential energy surface at a high level and a large basis set. Whereas, so I show that here in this table. So the OH and O, you basically, this is all the parameters that go into the calculation. Just a few molecular properties like rotational constant, spin orbit, lambda doublet, some dipole moments, and this set of parameters predicts exactly what happens. Whereas for the xenon OH calculation, we needed to, you know, to do a high-level ab initio calculation, simply because there the atom comes closer to the molecule, right? The atom does not have a dipole moment, so it happens at shorter range, and you just need the actual short-range potential. Okay, so to summarize the results for the... We have agreement on the absolute state-to-state cross-sections. We have the energy dependence, and we find the dominant process, and we have a model that predicts the parity changing very accurately, and here we analyzed more than 50% of the cross-section is a result of what happens at impact parameters larger than 12 Bohr. And okay, we find the dipole-dipole interaction is dominant at low energy, and at higher energies more NO states happen. The uncertainty in the dominant channel is 8%. The smaller processes are actually sensitive to changes in our model. If we leave out, for example, the octopole moment in the description of the long-range interaction, almost nothing happens with the parity changing collision, but the transition to the 7.5, for example, may change by a factor of 2 or 3 if you leave out the higher moment. So the smaller cross-sections are more and more sensitive to the details of what is happening. Okay, then the other system, the NHNH, where we did the calculations to, you know, predict the feasibility of an experiment, the feasibility of evaporative cooling. Well, I probably don't have to explain anything about evaporative cooling in this audience, but I just want to point out that this technique worked for metastable helium, which was cooled with a buffer gas, and then with evaporative cooling was brought down to a BC, and was done by in the group of John Doyle in 2009, and they are also able to produce the NH, and so the question is, you know, could they evaporative cooling to bring the NH down to a condensate? The 15 NH is a boson, and we have studied this problem over the years, starting with two NHNH molecules. But what we had until now had left out is what in principle can happen in exothermic reactions. So there are a lot of products, N2 plus H2 can be formed, N2H, you see there are, and then there is just stable molecules that are singlet and triplet states. So there's a lot of different species that can, in principle, be formed in a barrierless reaction of NHNH. The question is, does it happen in cold and ultra-cold collisions? In this case, we calculated the potentials. So there's not a long-range model, it's accurate ab initio potentials. And here, we have two triplet molecules, so it's not as bad as the OHNO, but there are three potentials you have to calculate because of the spins can couple to a quintet, a triplet, and a singlet. And we calculate the four-dimensional potential. So the approximation we made is we kept the NH distance fixed. So we are just studying the entrance channel of the reaction. And if you make it to short range, okay, then we say maybe a reaction can happen. And we don't attempt to predict products. We first want to know, you know, is chemical reaction going to happen or not. And this is sort of a 3D plot, but sometimes it's easier just to look at the one-dimensional cut of the potential. And then you see here are three potentials as a function of the distance. There's the quintet that is more van der Waals-like, and then there is the triplet and the singlet that here go down to very deep chemical. Well, so if the idea is if you make it on the singlet or triplet potential to, 5 or 6 Bohr distance, then from there you can expect chemical reaction to proceed to some product. So to study this collision, we have a Hamiltonian with these ingredients. Again, the kinetic energy, the centrifugal term. Now the potential that we actually have at 4 or 3 four-dimensional potentials, the monomer terms, and what is important in cold and ultra-cold collisions is the magnetic dipole-dipole interaction. So we call this the intermolecular spin-spin term. And then there are the monomer terms, the Hamiltonians of the NH. Okay, we have the rotation. We have coupling between spin and rotation, and that can potentially be important. The spin. Maybe I forgot to mention, in a trap you come in on the quintet surface, the upper surface where nothing happens, but if the spin flips, then potentially you get a chemical reaction, or at least trap loss. So this is an important term, spin rotation, and then there is a spin-spin term that has a bigger constant. This spin-spin coupling constant is in the order of a wave number, and that is the interaction with the magnetic field. So this term we call the intramolecular spin-spin, and that is the intermolecular spin-spin. And I wrote here down that magnetic dipole term. So with that Hamiltonian, we do a couple channels calculation, and we include the magnetic field. And that means it's easiest to work in an uncoupled basis. So we basically have a channel basis that consists of rotational states of the molecule, and then the spin, and then molecule B the rotation, and molecule B the spin, and the end over end rotation. And then the initial state has the spins aligned with the magnetic field. Then we do a scattering calculation where we impose reactive boundary conditions, and that simply means, as in a capture model, when you make it to the short range, to say 4 Bohr, whatever gets there, we assume will proceed to react. And we enforce that. It's a time independent calculation, so you can perfectly enforce these boundary conditions. For comparison, we also took the paper of Paul and put in the formulas for the universal limit, where you calculate the van der Waals length, the scattering length, and then you get the universal results for elastic and reactive cross sections, just for comparison to the accurate calculation. And we developed a propagator to deal with these reactive boundary conditions, but this is more a technical issue that I can skip for now. I can explain if anyone is interested in that. And let's go straight to the results. Function of energy from a microkelvin to 1 Kelvin, we see the elastic cross sections up here. They go to a constant value according to the weakness threshold laws. Then down here we have the inelastic processes where the spin flip, but you go back out to the same molecules that came in, so no chemical reaction. And then here in green, that is the reactive channel. And so what you immediately notice is that the probability for chemical reaction is actually at least at 1 Gauss here, and at low temperatures, it's a few orders of magnitude more likely to have chemical reaction than to have a spin flip and go back out. Here we also did calculations where we only included the quintet potential, and that explains the elastic and the inelastic processes can be explained with a single potential energy surface, but the reactive process is only possible on the singlet and triplet, so it has that. Then, as a so that was at 1 Gauss. Then, as a function of the magnetic field, we have here the reactive cross section, the upper one. It's the largest one, and it's dominant from small field to larger fields. Then it's bigger than the elastic cross section, at least at this 1 microkelvin. And you can see, as a function of the magnetic field, at low magnetic field, the inelastic spin-changing process is unlikely. But if you increase the magnetic field, the inelastic cross-sections go up. And at a very high magnetic field, inelastic and reactive become sort of similar. Here we also did two calculations, the dashed line, where we switched off some terms. And then in particular, here, the green dashed line, this one, that is when we switch off the intramolecular spin-spin coupling, the one wave number coupling that couples the spin to the rotation of the molecule. If you switch that off, reactive reaction drops considerably. So that is the dominant term that allows chemical reaction. And then if we switch off the magnetic dipole, the intermolecular spin-spin, then the inelastic process drops. So that is the intermolecular spin-spin coupling is what drives the inelastic spin-inelastic processes. Okay, here is a function of the energy. The elastic cross-section up here. And then in green, you see the reactive cross-sections that can become dominant in the ultra-cold limit. And the dashed line here, in this case, is what the universal limit is predicting. And this is our actual calculation. It's a little bit less. And here you see the inelastic processes for increasing magnetic fields. And at high magnetic field, inelastic and reactive become similar. The process is not exactly universal. So the inelastic process is very much dependent on the magnetic field. The reactive process is not, which means that action with a magnetic field in this system is maybe not going to be an interesting possibility. I have 1 minute to show that our results depend, because in the ultra cold limit, right, that is the scattering length that you can never get from ab initio potential. You're never accurate enough, so you have an uncertainty, and we model that uncertainty in the scattering length by changing the reduced mass of the complex, and then you can see how various processes can the cross-section can change over many orders of magnitude, just because in the ultra-cold limit you're so sensitive. But we still see that, okay, so we don't know where reality is on this axis, but we can see the probability for something to be true. And we see here an example where the reactive cross-section is larger than the elastic one. And we see here in very small fields the inelastic processes are down there. At higher magnetic fields, they come close to the reactive processes. So this brings me to the conclusion. The reaction mechanism for reaction is short range. So it's the intermolecular spin. The inelastic processes happen in long range, the intermolecular spin-spin coupling. The process is not universal, at least not perfectly. And the elastic inelastic processes we can calculate with one potential, and below 0.1 Kelvin, chemical reaction is just the most likely process. And the reaction is weakly dependent on the magnetic field. And this, even though it's not totally excluded, the chances that the evaporative cooling is going to work are a little bit less than what we thought up to the point that we included chemical reaction. Thank you.
Okay, questions for Garrett? Olivier, and then Jeremy.
I mean, it's amazing, these long-range things, how it works. And I was just wondering, because you were kind of saying nothing about this reactive boundary conditions, right? So I was wondering, when you take this NH, NH, if you would have used this long-range model, I mean, is your long-range model is compatible with this reactive boundary limit that you are talking about? Or I'm not sure that I got well the point here, because part of your dynamics here is at long range, this is what you say. Then, of course, you have a short range dynamic, and you said that you use this method that you just mentioned, which is reactive boundary conditions. Okay. So I was wondering, is there a parameter there, or what is the...
Okay, let me... First, your question is, how far do you get with the long range model here, right? Clearly, you have dipole-dipole interaction, so there is a long range. However, for chemical reaction to occur, you somehow have to get from the quintet potential to the singlet or triplet. Well, long range model will not tell you that. And as I've shown, it's the spin-spin term on the NH molecule that drives the chemical reaction. That means that you need to come in close to you, and the anisotropy of the potential will sort of give rotation of the molecule that couple with the spin. And so the long range model here will not tell you anything about the probability of chemical reaction, because you need the anisotropy in the short range potential to drive chemical reaction.
So what I mean is that you made the calculation indeed by coupling those two surfaces, indeed the quintet and the triplet.
All the potentials were, all three of them were in the calculation, and we put on the singlet and the triplet potential, we put boundary conditions, incoming flux boundary conditions at 4 bore. So that means we couple all the three spin states, and then of course all the kinetic energy. And this is closed because the quintet is just repulsive. But on the singlet and the triplet potential, whatever gets to 4 bore reacts.
Okay. Yes. I think you've answered about half my question, but I'll try and ask the other half. So clearly your mechanism for the reaction is, as you say, that the spin-spin interaction is driving you from the quintet state to triplet and singlet states where that can react. I'm trying to get a feel for how wide a class of systems this type of mechanism is going to affect. So first of all, it's not going to affect systems which have doublet sigma rather than triplet sigma molecules, or not nearly so much, because the doublet sigma is much less, because you don't have the intramolecular
spin. In principle, with the doublets, of course, you have to flip the spin, but you don't have the spin-spin term, the wave number spin-spin that we have for the triplet, right? For the doublet, you have more the spin rotation, which is 10 minus 4 or 10 minus 5.
And it's a third-order mechanism rather than a second-order one.
Yes.
But the other issue is that these are barrierless reactions, is that right?
Yes.
So, and you probably have to get into a distance of well inside 10 Bohr before the transfer between the electronic states is starting to happen significantly.
Yes.
So this probably won't, or in some cases won't affect reactions that have barriers, or not nearly so much.
If you have a barrier that prevents you from reaching this short range, then yes, the chemical process is then safe. The inelastic transitions were driven by the magnetic dipole-dipole, which happens at the other side of the centrifugal barrier, so that will remain
there.
The same.
They're always there.
But that wasn't our biggest problem, right? Because these cross-sections were acceptable.
Yeah.
And with a barrier, I think, yes, you wouldn't make it to this point, and you wouldn't mix the spins, and
it's essentially not looking good news for any triplet sigma system where there are barrierless reactions, even on different surfaces. But other categories of reaction may need own arguments.
Yeah. I mean, oxygen, right, is the same electronic structure, O2. It can't go anywhere, but of course it can. You will have the mixing of the spins at short range with the same mechanism, but there's no chemical reaction there. But
yeah, so you might get onto a deeper surface where a bone mechanism where sequestration can occur. Yeah. Yes, okay.
Did you play with your short-range boundary conditions for the reactions, like having full loss chemical reactions or half loss? Or did you play with your short-range chemical boundary condition at short range for the chemical reactions, like to have full
That's
loss or
point.
Half loss? Or
So we have some freedom, right, to impose the boundary conditions. We can place, well, you can think of maybe you can put them at 5, you can put them at 4, so we move that wall. But you have more choices when imposing the boundary conditions. For one thing, you can, the way you do it, you first calculate, diagonalize the interaction at a fixed distance. That gives you adiabatic channels. And then you can simply do whatever is below 0 is reactive, whatever is above 0 is closed. But you can also look at the slope of the adiabatic potential, and then whatever is going down, you can call open. Whatever goes up, you can say, okay, maybe it's not closed here, but it will be closed, and we leave that out. So we played with these options, and it was basically didn't make any difference. So the reactive boundary conditions at 4 Bohr, the way you implemented, had no effect on the reactive cross section. So we checked that.
Very briefly, in the spirit of what we have heard this morning about the possibility maybe to kind of trap metastable molecules, in the case of NH, if I remember correctly, they were able to slow down the delta state of the NH. So I was just wondering, would it be crazy to make such calculation between two NH in the delta state, and then which would be protected? Could we already say that they will not be protected for, you know, inelastic or reactive collision, or would they be protected by some bioreaction? Do we know anything about that?
Okay, let me think. So that's a delta.
Yeah.
The triplet. What is it?
I don't remember.
Singlet delta.
I think it was singlet delta, right?
I think the plan there from the experimental side was not to immediately use that delta state, but to actually, drive it up, make it spontaneous to come down to exactly this state.
But it's a long-lived state, right?
It's a long-lived state, but I think I don't know whether you. I mean, the idea there was that you could reload and increase density. I don't know, you may not have enough to do collisions with that.
But I was wondering for fun, I was wondering for fun, does this kind of modeled approach would reveal, I mean, either you do some kind of long-range model, and could we say something about the fact that there would be a barrier or there would not be a barrier? I mean, I just don't know. I mean, just to see if we could manipulate those contestable molecules.
It is the model that we use for OH and O that we could best apply to that delta state. Yeah. And I don't think you have the you need the spin flip to get reaction is not the issue there. Mm. So it's just making it to sufficiently short range. So I would think if you want to collide these delta states and want to predict reaction, the model that we use for OH and O, then with the reactive boundary conditions, should do it. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Without having to calculate too much detail of the.
I think so.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm just curious if the in the NHNH where you showed the suppression of the inelastic rate relative to the reactive at low collision energy, if that could be similar to an effect we sometimes find in atom-atom collisions where coming in as an S wave at low energy, flipping the spin requires going out in a D wave, and therefore its exit channel barrier suppressed.
Yes.
Is that what's going on?
I think that is. I didn't discuss that. So I think, well, here basically as a function of magnetic field, you can see it, right? If you increase the magnetic field, the inelastic process becomes more and more exothermic. Well, the big difference between the inelastic and the reactive process, is exothermic by, well, EVs, by infinite, almost infinite amount of energy. And if you have a larger magnetic field, the inelastic process becomes more and more exothermic, and it's easier to find your way out, and it becomes similar. So, right, it's also here that you can then get over the centrifugal barrier more easily. In the reactive case, you have so much energy available, you can come in S-wave and outgoing, the centrifugal barrier is negligible. So I think that is basically the physically, so in hindsight, it's kind of clear why the reactive process, it also involves spin flip, but once you have done that, it's very exothermic, and the reaction just goes.
Right. Yeah. The reactive one is spin flip inside, and the other one is.
Yeah. That is a subtle
inside,
difference,
though. It has to get out.
Yeah. There's a subtle difference still that you have. You come in on the quintet, you can stay in the S equals two state and flip the spin, or you can go from the quintet to the triplet. That's also a spin flip, but it's a different kind of spin flip. So if you stay in the quintet, you flip the spin. It's already inelastic. But that's a slightly different from what. That's not enough to get reaction. To get reaction, you have to recouple the spins. The total spin can reorient. You have S equals two, and of course, if you have angular momentum from the overall, you can change just the S has five components. And so the orientation of the S equals two vector can change in space, but you stay on the van der Waals potential. And so it's so if you compare, it's slightly different way of changing the spin. But apparently this is what.
Okay, final question on the NO plus OH, which was really a high energy collision.
Yes.
You found, I think, essentially you were using a very crude and approximate short-range potential, and essentially I think you're saying that these collision rates are completely independent of the short-range potential. Is that basically because you're summing over many partial waves and
yes.
averaging over many phases? Or is it just that, I mean, all of the reaction really occurs at long range and impact parameter?
It is, so yeah, so the partial waves, about I had 200 or something. We actually worked it out. You can assign, of course, an impact parameter to each partial wave for a given energy, and then the parity changing, you see 50% of the cross-section arises from impact parameters beyond 12 Bohr. Well, there our long-range model was identical to ab initio potential.
Essentially, it never samples the short range.
Never sampled the short range.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the smaller and smaller cross-sections you get, These are typically things that happen at shorter range. So we saw the sensitivity of our result to the short range increases if you go to the smaller processes. Where is my table? So this process doesn't really care about the short range. This one a little more, and then if you go to the 7.5, even more, because getting two quantum of angular momentum in there requires more anisotropy, means you have to get in closer, and then our model eventually. But here we have processes of a cross section of only a square angstrom. If they had been off by a factor of 10, I would still have been perfectly happy with the result. I would say, okay, well, they're in a way actually better than you would expect.
Okay, I'm going to ask one last quick question. So, Heather Lewandowski, when she
yes.
spoke of her experiments, talked about three free radicals, right? She talked about at the beginning OH, NH, and CH. And now we're going to hear more about OH in the next talk. You've talked about NH, and you've said that perhaps the prospects are not as good as we might have hoped. So what about CH?
Well, of course, here we are still talking an entirely different regime, right? We're talking about collisions at 100 wave number. The evaporative cooling of the OH is it's this system, but on a very different condition. So then the story completely changes. Because at the ultra cold limit, you suddenly have to this dispersion interaction that the C6, the repulsive C6 that is controlling what is happening in the ultra cold limit, and that doesn't play any role at this temperature. But on the other hand, these molecules, all the molecules Heather mentioned. At this energy, at these collision energies, I think we should be able to predict the dominant inelastic and elastic processes with this model, just plugging in a few parameters of the molecule, and we run it, and we should be able to predict these collisions.
So is CH next on the list?
So CH, if Heather comes, that's why I asked her whether she would see a collision. If she collides CH with something, I will rerun my program, and a week later I can tell her.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Let's thank Garrett again and all the speakers for a great talk. Okay, we'll meet back in 30 minutes.